another episode of Sacred Cinema here on 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, for the next half an hour, and this week's episode is entitled The Church of Sport. I've been watching a lot of sport recently. We are getting to the business end of things in the Super Rugby season. Great win for the ACT Brumbies this weekend. Corey Toole, what a try, mate. Hope you're listening. Bonus point winning against the Highlanders. We would be pretty happy with that, let me just say. And I've been meaning to do this episode for quite a while, I think, because when I watch, I love sport. And when I watch sport, I feel like my body does the same thing it does when I watch a movie. You know, you've got characters that you love and you hate in a movie. You watch sport, you've got players that you love, players on the other team you hate or you can't help but you love to hate them, blah, blah, blah. And I feel like we do a very similar thing when we watch a game of sport, when we watch a movie or read a book, etc. And I want to talk about that. I want to designate an entire week talking about that sort of thing. We're going to talk about this week, you know, ask questions about what can sport teach us about ourselves and reality itself. In the same way that we often ask, you know, what can films teach us about ourselves and the world around us. Very similar to the episode we did many months ago on World War II, where we tried to ask questions about, like, what does, you know, the event of World War II, what can that tell us about human beings? And we tried to do that by looking at films about World War II. This week we're going to ask, what can sport teach us about being human, the world around us, etc., by watching films that are about a given sporting team or a given athlete or an important match or something like that. The first one we're going to talk about is Any Given Sunday from 1999, directed by Oliver Stone. We're then going to move on to Raging Bull from 1980, directed by Martin Scorsese, of course. And then we're going to finish off with Bennett Miller's 2011 film Moneyball. But we have got a lot to get through because I think this has been a really fun week to prepare for. So I'm really excited to present it to you, dear listener. Let's get things started now, though, with Any Given Sunday. So, long story short, this is basically a film that tracks this fictitious team, the Miami Sharks, in, let's call it like a middle section of their season, kind of, and that's going to be quite significant as we talk a bit more about this movie in a second. It's not the first game. The first game of the movie isn't really the first game of the season, and the last game of the movie isn't really the last game of the season either. In talking about this film this week, I want to talk about how I think one of the big takeaways from this film is that it sort of talks about how humans yearn for fiction. And we know this from art, you know, but not every people, we know this from art and culture and movies, and, you know, we love watching movies and reading books because of the you know, the insights and the way that it changes our thinking and how we escape, whatever that might mean. But you understand what I mean? We are drawn to art and culture and things like that. But there are some people that aren't that big on art, you know, like art and culture, that they prefer sport. And I think this film is a really good example or exemplifies how sport, we view sport as fiction. We view it as if it is art. We view it as if it is culture. And so we ultimately, I think when we watch this film, we ultimately view the film in the same way that we would view a sports team. And we could say the same in both ways. When you watch sport and you view a sports team, the stories that you're observing are similar to the stories of characters in a film that you might observe. Basically, in short, with a sporting team like the Miami Sharks, we have a group of flawed individuals, all with their own specific attributes, and we yearn to see them overcome obstacles that hold back their individuation or their maturation or their development as people, and we reach this sense of elation when they do, you know, when they score a try or score a touchdown or something like that. And you really do push for this as a viewer when you watch this film in particular. But what I think is quite clever about the film, and I think it's sort of unknown how intentional this is, but it certainly is intentional in certain aspects, and we'll touch on those in a second. But you really have to resist a lot of obstacles in the way in order to sort of push for that sense of elation, that sense of an arc, a natural arc, a natural development in some of these characters. Because I think one of the most notable features of this film, it's a really interesting viewing experience, especially when you look at it through this lens. But I would say one of the most notable features of this film is that there's this sort of motif of discontinuity. That is to say that it lacks continuity in a lot of ways. So, you know, on a basic level, as I mentioned before, the plot, I mean, what we see, the series of events is taking place in a kind of like an arbitrary point of the season. It doesn't have a natural arc in the sense of, you know, he takes this, it's not like Friday Night Lights where they go from the start to the end of the season. At the start, you're not sure if they're going to make it, and they overcome all sorts of obstacles to then, you know, get to some point at the end where you feel a sense of fulfillment. It's kind of like this random middle part. The most important aspect of this film, I think it's worth touching on, is that these are the shots themselves. So basically there's so many cutaways to just random shots, even to the sky, to rain, to scenes of Ben-Hur. Al Pacino might be talking, he's the coach of the Miami Sharks in the film, he might be talking diegetically within the film, but then Stone sort of cuts away to him doing something else, or like him in that same setting in that room, but his mouth isn't moving. So it's constantly breaking up momentum in this film. It's kind of constantly grabbing the viewer and saying, don't get caught in the narrative. A bit like, I suppose Pulp Fiction has that a little bit as well with the jumping around, but this film has it maybe on a more micro level of constantly kind of shaking the viewer and saying, don't get caught up in the monologue here. I want you to keep moving your attention. Stay off the natural narrative. Don't form a story out of this in an interesting kind of way. And that's not unsurprising for an Oliver Stone film. And at the end of the film, we have this very clear sense of unevenness, or a sense of inauthenticity, or maybe you could call it like the clumsiness of capitalism in terms of where the loyalties of the players and the coaches lie after they undergo this great adventure as a team, in quotation marks. And that's not surprising for an Oliver Stone film, because obviously he's always taking aim at the American elite and some of these bigger overarching hegemonic powers that make the average American citizen's life a lot more difficult than we'd like to believe. Think of something like Platoon or Born on the 4th of July or JFK or whatever. He's very much into conspiracies against the American people and that sort of thing. I'm not in that kind of tinfoil hat way, but you know what I mean. He's very he doesn't mind asking questions about what the establishment want us to believe about the American system. And so we could say that the film kind of aims to readjust or curb our sense of trust in the commercial sporting system. But I'm going to choose to take another view, which is that sort of despite the commerciality, or the inauthenticity or the vapidness of this whole commercial sports system where players are being sold off and they're commodified and you might go through this great journey with a team and then duck off to another team the next day, viewers still participate. Like, as viewers of the film, right, we're still wanting to see Jamie Foxx's character or Dennis Quaid's character reach that state of individuation or fulfillment or whatever. And I suppose what we could say about Any Given Sunday is that it really does tell us, when we reflect on our own experience watching the film, that how palpable, how intoxicating or compelling or alluring the sporting narrative is, right? Even if we are the ones constructing them, even if we're the ones putting in the pieces and ignoring certain things and emphasizing other things. And we do that when we watch sport, don't we? Like, we ignore maybe a dropped ball, or we ignore the fact that someone was drink driving or something on the weekend so that they can be our hero for that weekend. Or we might ignore the fact that Dan Carter or Johnny Wilkinson is actually a very good rugby player because he's on the other team. Like, for the longest time, I never wanted to accept that Beauden Barrett was a good rugby player just because of my biases, wanting that a certain narrative that made sense in my heart to work out, right? And this actually reminds me a lot of what we talk about when we talk about Ex Machina, where something can be facing us right at our nose and we can deny it, even if it's telling us that it's a lie, even though we see sponsors and things like that all over the arena, we know that it's just to make money, we can still trick ourselves into thinking this is important and get really angry when our team loses. But is there a danger? And I think you might have guessed that there might be a danger in getting too swept up in all that. Is there a danger in seeking nourishment from sport, and in particular sporting heroes? And at this point, I think it makes sense to move on to our next film. Before we do, just remind you are listening to 2XX 98.3 FM, People Powered Radio. I'm your host, Jimmy Bernasconi. Please stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX. And consider jumping onto our website if you're not there already, listening online too. Consider subscribing or sponsoring the show or subscribing to the station. But moving on now to Raging Bull. And now, if you want to talk about sports movies, this is probably the greatest film that is a sports film, I guess you could say. If you haven't seen this one, you've got to see. This is one of the top films you got to see, right? We've all seen it. But if you haven't seen it, this is the story of Jake LaMotta. Basically, he was an American boxer through the 40s and I suppose a little bit into the 50s. And I'll get into sort of more of the key plot points in a second. But basically, I want to talk about this one, how it really fleshes out the idea that nobility, like when we think about sporting heroes, and we think about, you know, the important ideals that they embody, the nobility or the virtuosity of an ideal or a trait or an attribute is very closely tied. It's very dependent on context, right? So we can kind of list out what LaMotta was respected or revered for as an athlete, right? He was tenacious, courageous, gritty, strong, resilient, persistent, enduring, confident, powerful, right? Those are all words that we generally think of as positive things. But then we start thinking about things like confidence, power. Well, I guess in the ring, they're all very virtuous, right? If you're an athlete and you're trying to win the match. But out of the ring, a lot of those words, right, they're really the sources of very horrific violence and undesirable behavior, which is ultimately what leads to the end for Jake LaMotta. And that's probably best described as a very pathetic end, almost to the point that you feel sorry for the guy, which is kind of unbelievable. And it's one of the many reasons why the film is so incredible, because he really is the worst kind of guy there is. You almost feel sorry for him by the end of this film. I'm not going to say that you do feel sorry for him because he does such terrible things, but you just feel this deep sense of pity, and it makes you feel sad that he could sink that low after being so talented and above. But we're not going to so much talk about, you know, poor old LaMotta. We want to break this down more and talk about sort of how can it be that these traditional values, these traditionally valued traits, persistence, endurance, tenacity, courage, all those things I listed before, how can they have such profoundly horrible consequences, particularly, you know, outside of the sporting arena? Well, why I think this film is so brilliant, personally, my favorite aspect of this film is that we often talk about, particularly on this show, but in society, we often talk about how no one really chooses to do the bad thing, right? That's a really complicated question, isn't it? People sort of just have a certain perspective of what they're doing, and they usually try and trick themselves, or they really do think what they're doing is the right thing, which is why governing the human race is so hard, because we all have very different ideas of what the right thing to do is, and particularly in a given moment. And we talked about this a lot when we did that movie, The Conference, the one about the Third Reich and how they came up with the final solution, how they really convinced themselves. They really thought what they were talking amongst each other in that room, that locked off room, they really thought what they were doing was the right thing to do. And that's what's so scary about things like the Holocaust and the terrible things that happened in the world. It's not just people opting out of morality. It's actually them thinking they're employing morality and in doing so convincing. You know, the road to hell is paved in good intentions, right? And when we watch a movie like Raging Bull, we start to see how an individual person, let alone, you know, Adolf Hitler, but how an individual everyday person could very easily convince themselves that what they're doing is acceptable, even if to the outside world it totally isn't, right? And part of why that happens is because maybe 5 minutes prior that thing was acceptable, or in 5 minutes' time that thing will be acceptable when you're in a different context, but in a very specific sliver, in a specific moment, it's not. So the simple example is punching someone, right? Punching someone's lights out. In the boxing ring, that's an act of skill. It's an act of competence, bravery. And you might not like boxing, but you can't deny that throughout human history, punching someone has been a virtuous act in given context, right? You might be punching someone in a war scene. You might be punching Adolf Hitler, or you might be rescuing your puppy dog from a crocodile and going to punch it in the nose so it gives your dog away. Or just basically in a superhero movie, when you watch Captain Marvel or Wakanda Forever, you know, you see the good guys punching someone and it's a virtuous thing. But of course, out of the ring, punching someone, punching your wife or punching your brother like LaMotta does in the film, is seriously one of the worst things a person can do. So if someone, and let's call this kind of person a bad person, but it really is all of us, if a bad person wants to convince themselves that what they're doing is a good act, they can very easily, and I guess you could say it's kind of deliberate when they do this, but it doesn't necessarily have to be. I mean, what does deliberate even mean, right? Basically, they can very easily convince themselves to, or just deliberately, or sort of just, the point I want to get to is that they can misread a given circumstance in a very convenient way so that they can employ a certain trait or act or belief to indulge and do something that the rest of the world probably thinks is appalling. You can convince yourself of that if you have a point of reference or you've seen someone do something else before in another context and you simply think that this is an equivalent context and you do it, even though maybe in the back of your mind you know it isn't. And I think that word indulgence is really important. You know, we're indulging this sort of deep animalistic urge that, you know, maybe you know it's wrong, but on a cognitive level, you kind of trick yourself into thinking it's right. Or the other way around, where on a cognitive level, you might have doubts, but on an animalistic level, on a primal level, your gut kind of tells you to do it, right? Again, it's always going to be contextual and who's watching you do it and where you are when you do it, right? So I guess what we're kind of saying is that there is a temptation to indulge that is utterly intoxicating. And I think the example of that actually in Raging Bull is that scene, the famous scene where he keeps telling Joe Pesci to punch him in the face. And you could say he's kind of doing it to sort of deliberately show off how strong and tough and brave a person he is. And all those things are kind of virtuous things in a sense. But what he's really doing is he's indulging how brave and how tough and strong he is. It's actually quite a masturbatory, self-indulgent act that LaMotta is engaging in. So this is, but I don't want to isolate things to just Jake LaMotta. This is something that we see in the everyday. We see it in ourselves. We all do. We probably did it at some point today where we indulged something where we probably gave too much emphasis to a certain trait or attribute in a given context that in the short term meant that we indulge and we gained something on the short term, but we probably feel a little bit guilty about it, and we know that we probably employed that trait in the wrong context, right? And it's certainly an archetype, right? This kind of Jake LaMotta figure, like this very insecure, constantly trying to prove themselves tough, jumpy, always got a chip on their shoulder kind of person. Like if you think of like Jay from The Inbetweeners or like 50% of the guys I went to high school with, probably myself included, like constantly always trying to like, you know, prove to people that they're tougher than they are. But it really comes from a place of insecurity and not actually knowing, not being comfortable in the fact that there is somewhere out there a correct way to act that we're sort of choosing to ignore, taking the low road. So it is quite confusing though. Like if we've all done it, it's quite confusing. So you know, we've got this big list of traits, we've got this big list of attributes that we all have at our disposal, and we're all pretty guilty of misusing them. So what are we supposed to do about this? Like, this is a very archetypal place we're in. We're all capable of falling into this trap. What should we do? Is there a strategy that we can employ? Well, at this point, let's move on to our third and final film for today, Bennett Miller's 2011 film, Moneyball. And if you haven't seen this one, pretty much it stars Brad Pitt, and he plays the general manager of a baseball team, the Oakland Athletics. And they're a very cheap team with not nearly as much money as the other teams in the MLB. And with no resources, he pretty much takes them to the top, pretty much through innovations in statistics. And this is kind of like the film, which is like when statistics met baseball, pretty much. And I want to talk about this. I want to use a phrase here. I think this film explores, let's say, the art of maximization. So in a completely theoretical sense, and we'll bring it back to the movie in a sec, but every person or every group of people, pretty much any entity, can essentially be conceived as a hyper-colorful, kaleidoscopic collage or collective of many, many traits, right? As we've already sort of discussed, you know, we listed all those out a second ago. But as we kind of established in talking about Raging Bull, it's sort of just like a big bubbling, boiling pot of mess waiting to be poured all over the world and cause all sorts of trouble or just honestly just create a big old mess, which is what we sort of see at the start of the film. Like you've got all these players and swinging bats and throwing balls and someone's got this arm and someone's got that leg and blah, blah, blah. And it's sort of not organized. It's not, you know, the team isn't cohesive. Things aren't really working out. But with sport, and this is why sport is so important, what's such a helpful example of this is that if you have a specific singular goal or a limited set of goals, let's say, that supersedes any other potential goal or desired outcome, you can hypothetically, with the requisite computing power, and that's kind of Jonah Hill's genius mind in the film, his character's genius mind, if you have a singular goal to aim at, you can align all of those many attributes in such a way as to maximize the given entity's ability to achieve that given goal, right? You can take all of their attributes, put it in a certain order, and if you get it in a particular order, there's going to be one order that means that that thing, that team or that group of people can now push in a direction that is way more effective than any other, than if it had aligned its skills and attributes in any other way. And we know that if you've ever worked in a workplace, you know about this. You want to emphasize certain people's skills and de-emphasize other people's weaknesses or their other weaknesses. And we see that best in the film. I think it's that great scene when all the old guys are sitting around the table, and they're talking about how, you know, and they're trying to select people in the old school traditional way, and they're talking about stupid things like a guy's, you know, some of the players have a good face or a good arm or a good eye and that sort of thing. And Brad Pitt kind of slams his fist on the table. He's like, look, you guys can sort of think about all that stuff till the cows come home, but none of it really matters. It all, you know, what it all comes down to, the only relevant thing, despite the fact that you might feel like all those things are relevant, it's all rooted in whether they can score runs, right? At the end of the day, baseball, the game of baseball, is won by the team that has more runs than the other team. It doesn't matter how you get them. It doesn't matter if it looks sexy. It doesn't matter who gets them. As long as at the end of the day, one team has more runs than the other, they win, right? And if we go back to something like Raging Bull, for example, when you think about LaMotta just sort of sitting around his house, muzzing about, with no sort of philosophical virtue, and he only has his sort of pure animalistic instincts to listen to, that's all his attributes will ever be employed to serve, right? Because he'll create nothing but carnage, because he doesn't actually have a direction, a singular goal to align all of those attributes toward, right? As opposed to when he's in the ring and he can take his bravery, take his toughness, take his endurance and put it all towards a specific noble virtue, which is to win the game of sport. And we can debate whether that's noble or not, but in the context of today's conversation, let's say it is, right? So there is a very cynical Marxist way of viewing a film like Moneyball, and I'm sure that there's plenty of people that have talked about this, which is a kind of way, you know, you look at it where you know, it makes, turns human beings into nothing more than units of labor. And I'm not saying that what we should do in life is take groups of people and you know, reduce them down to specific attributes and statistics and put them in an order. It's very interesting. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about the film Gattaca, and this theme seems to keep coming up. I mean, I think a movie like Moneyball and Gattaca would work so beautifully together, where you sort of talk about the power of reducing people down to statistics in Moneyball and how it is able to lead to a victorious situation. But then on the other hand, in Gattaca, what it does is that, you know, once you can reduce people down to statistics, you can then organize people into who is the most effective person in a given thing, and eventually you will necessarily have, ultimately, if you had the computing power, the entirety of human civilization on a singular list, on a singular plane. And that's kind of what we've seen in a capitalist system, isn't it? That if you can reduce everyone down to their net worth, you actually can create a very distinct hierarchy that makes a great deal of people very depressed if they're on the bottom 50 or even 60, 70%, given that it's an exponential curve. But I'm not going to take that cynical view this week. We're going to try and see the positives in this and maybe look at this sort of on the level of the individual and say that I think the key takeaway here is that the power of whittling down, the power of reducing down, you know, if you think about like a reduction when you're cooking, the beauty of that or the power of that is that if you can do that with your goals down to a specific flavor, down to one specific target, one specific outcome, that makes decision making a lot easier. Right, it makes your life a lot easier as a person, and it makes your life a lot. It makes you probably a better person if you can whittle down your goals to a very virtuous and noble goal. So let's sort of rope everything together that we've talked about this week, because we've kind of gone on quite a wondrous athletic journey this week without actually talking about sport. We really have talked a lot more about movies and some of these more sort of abstract ideas than sport itself. But let's go back to the sport. Sport shows us that we love fiction, right? Even when the fictitiousness of sport is right in our faces, even when we see the sponsors littered all over the arena and on the jerseys and everything, we can't help but try and believe in the stories that we're seeing. We can't help but see the virtuousness. And, you know, I know people like Noam Chomsky have views about sport, which is just a distraction from you know, what's actually happening in corporate America, blah, blah, blah. But we like seeing people endure and put themselves through a difficult place to the point that they can reach a place of individuation and fulfillment and satisfaction, right? We like seeing that arc. And even when it's clearly manufactured, we still deny how artificial it is, and we still persist and believe that it's a those are real stories. But the nobility of the ideals that we value in a given sports person, right? They can't just be carried around in our pockets, right? When we see our favorite athlete do something incredible, we can't just say, well, because I saw, you know, Mike Tyson punch someone and that made me feel good, I can't just then go punch people to make myself feel better, right? Just because I saw someone kick a goal and kick a round object really fast, I'm not just going to go walk around and boot any circular object I can see in the world really hard into a net. No, it's a lot more abstract than that. We need to understand that these ideals are actually the virtuousness of them, the nobility of these ideals and their values, they are contextual. And not just in sport, but sport gives us a specific outlet where we can see certain ideals thrive and be, you know, be things that we value. But we have to remember that the sport is a specific thing, and in the same way that doing a certain act on the sporting field is not okay somewhere else, the same goes for every kind of act and virtue in the world, that there are specific contexts where they're more noble than not. So ultimately, just like in sports, we need to have a kind of whittled down or isolated or narrow or limited set of goals that we can use to better align our ideals, align those values and attributes. It gives us a much better sense of when and when not to employ certain ideas and certain values and ideals. Because this is really, if you think about it, this is really the only way we can end up actually doing the right thing, right? If you don't have a singular target, if you are just left to muzz about in your lounge room and you've got all of these attributes at your disposal, you're just going to spin around like a cyclone, like a raging bull, let's say. And I don't think I need to sort of bang this on the head too much, but, you know, a bull, right? A bull runs around, you put the flag out, the red, you give it the singular thing, that's what it gives the tunnel vision, that's what it goes down. I think that Moneyball and Raging Bull do go excellently, if I may say so. I think it does work very well together, but I think that is very clear. But I think it was still in a bit of an abstract place, right? Let's hone in on Moneyball and the lessons from that a little bit better. If you think about it, right, this idea of emphasizing, you know, runs on the board kind of thing, a specific goal, everything really should just be a means to a specific noble end, right? That's pretty much what monotheism is, and it's probably why it's been so infectious all of these centuries, right? Yeah, you know, for example, if you're a Christian, right, basically you can whittle everything you do in life down to the simple question of what would Jesus do? Right? Or another way of saying is, what would he want me to do? Now, we've entitled this week's episode, The Church of Sport, right? So maybe the next time, and I'm not saying people need to, you know, really treat sport as a religion as such, but maybe the next time we're confronted with a difficult situation in life, it is important that we think about our favorite sports heroes, but not in the real version, not in the sense of who they are as real people, not in the sense of, you know, what would they do? You know, we see them in the news going around the streets, getting caught drunk driving or doing terrible things to their wives and things like that. Maybe we need to think, well, what would the version of them do, the one that we invent when we watch them on the field, what would that made up version that we enjoy, that we tune into every weekend, what would they do? We've got to ask ourselves, what would they do or what would I have to do for them to think that I'm a good sport? Well, unfortunately, that's all we've got time for this week on Sacred Cinema. I've been your host, Jimmy Bernasconi, here on 2XX 98.3 FM, people-powered radio. Stay tuned for more quality radio programming here on 2XX, or jump onto our website if you're not there already to consider subscribing to the station or sponsoring the show or any of 2XX's wonderful shows. Any of that would be very much appreciated. Old sport. See you again next week. Cheers.